Oh, hi, Larry?
Yes.
Oh, hi, this is Arnold calling from Cowes in California.
Hi, how are you doing? Good to talk to you.
Oh, good to speak to you, Larry.
My dog is barking. Hang on a minute. Let me just sort it out. Here we are. This is better. In fact,
it's better than Chigwell barking.
Oh, you know it. I used to have a chum out that way.
Oh, okay.
When I was at the art school, Central School.
Oh, yeah.
I roomed out there for a term. Mm. But it's a damn long way out of London, I know that.
Yeah.
You see, you sound awfully English, but you're living out in California.
Oh, yeah, I was born and raised in London, and but I've been here just over 30 years.
Oh, my goodness.
So, but I go back every year to see family and, you know, I suppose I keep the language.
Well, very much so, yeah. We had a gig in Brighton over the weekend, Bonzo.
Oh, that's right. How did that go?
It was good. It was just, you know, I mean, people just love what we do, you know, and we love doing it, and it's a great combination, and away you go. Without sounding too blasé, I mean, you know, it's houses full and people just yelling and screaming for more.
Hey.
And I am, of course, particularly wonderful.
Well, you are Mr. Wonderful.
I am Mr. Wonderful. Good evening. It's a real pleasure. So that was good fun to see everybody. We had a period when we didn't see each other for a long, long time. You know, Bonzo. Viv died, as you know, and Dennis died, first of all, and then Viv decided to call it a day, we kind of lost touch for quite a while, big wacky periods of no real communication. And I guess the last sort of 3 or 4 years, we picked things up again, and it's good.
Yeah, I mean, really, the energy is fabulous. You know, from what I've seen, I've heard some, Louisa sent me some recordings of some of the gigs and things. Really, it's just, I love it. It's so important for you guys to be back there. You were so important back then, and I think you're important now. I mean, it's needed.
Yeah, you know what? I think we're just as valid, you know, now, more than ever. And because we went through so much together as friends, as a band, as you do, you know, most bands do this, the ones that can manage to stay together, and you hit the low spots and you insult each other so much you can barely get off the chair from rage, because they've said so many awful things to you. One time, Mr. Slater actually hit me. Can you believe it? He actually threw a punch. And I probably deserved it, because we had a pretty tedious day, and I think I really got on his nerves, and I don't know, it was only a sort of little tap, really.
Yeah.
But bands do a lot worse than that to each other.
Yes, indeed. We've seen the headlines.
Wow.
But yeah, well, let's, you know, the most important question I can ask you from Britain, though, is what tea do you drink and how do you drink it, if you do?
I drink Earl Grey.
Ah.
And with a dash of milk and sometimes some honey.
Ah, okay.
I'm terribly posh. But I drink more coffee, I must admit, than tea.
Oh, you still can do coffee then?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've gained a pretty good constitution from my dear father, who passed on when he was 94, and touch wood, I'm in pretty good shape. Thinking about it, I've said goodbye to alcohol, which you know, was the monkey on my back for most of my life. As indeed Vivian's and Neil to a certain extent. I said goodbye to that 6 years ago. And in fact, the night my dear daddy died, I was arrested and spent the night in Abingdon Jail.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, drink driving. Sure. And yeah, I was running a friend to the station over in a local station. We couldn't get a taxi for love of money. I said, I don't want to drive to Goring, where I fairly close to, and she said, I've got to get to London. I had this important thing, and I've got to do this. And I said, well, walk there. She said, no. So I foolishly drove her there, and the law found me, as they do. He wouldn't have anybody. I said, look, my dad is still warm. He's dead in hospital. Give me a break. And I said, you can see my house. It's just, I'm in the next village. Come along with me. So I was banged up in Abingdon Jail, which wasn't much fun.
Yeah, you didn't write any great novels whilst you were in there then.
No, I didn't, no. It's probably an episode that's best forgotten, he said, announcing it to all of California. But I'm like that.
Well, with the internet now, everything's out there everywhere at all times, so...
It is, isn't it? It's frightening how you can release an image, a photograph, and it's round the net.
Yeah.
In no time at all, but... You know, God bless the net.
I know. Who'd have thought it back then?
I still don't understand how it works, do you? I mean, I just don't get it.
Oh, the internet tubings?
You do. Well, you probably do. You're probably far more technical than me, but I don't understand how the damn thing works. But it's just quite... It is amazing.
It is. A lot of heavy equipment all over the world.
Yeah, lorry loads of it.
Yeah, exactly. Being shuffled on rail lines secretly. Yeah.
Well, that's an image I've got for my book. There's an old black and white photo of loads of lorries of military equipment going from A to B in an old grey black and white job, yeah. And I put that in to illustrate a certain page of my book and said, these modern tours, shitloads of equipment. And it's so funny, it's just so obviously not a modern tour, but it tickled me, you know. I thought it was funny.
Well, that's the whole Bonzo twist on things, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's that little twist that I think we have, you know, and in various degrees of twistiness,
right.
throughout the band. I mean, I guess I'm getting camper than ever in my act. You know, I've sort of got I've got Mr. Wonderful, obviously. Then there's me as me, and then this chap I'm developing called Lord Larrington.
Oh yes,
who's rather fun, and you know, he's. He's a waffler, but he has a different kind of twist on everything again. And then, of course, you've got all the others, and they've all got little... They all like the twist, you know,
right. So it's good. From what I understand, you became close friends with Viv Stanchel first.
Yeah, I'm just... yes, of course I did. We were at the same college, and I remember we sort of met on the sidewalk, the pavement. We were just about to cross the road to go and get some lunch. We hadn't officially met each other, but we were checking each other out as boys do. I'd heard about him, and he'd heard about me, and we were in different departments. He was in the illustration department downstairs, and I was up in the graphics. And we'd heard rumors, you know, about this dandified red-haired beast that was causing much chaos and confusion, as indeed he'd heard about me throwing art school chairs out the window at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this stuff we used to call waddies, which was made out of old newspaper and soaked in various liquids, and we'd throw them out. It was just crazy. You know. It was. We finally met and really got on very well, and we started sharing a flat together, a couple of flats together. During our time at college.
Yeah.
He was a wondrous boy to live with. As mean as a fiddler, as in terms of literal things like, you know, cigarettes. He was so mean to the ciggies and stuff. And, you know, I'd say, can I have a... He'd be borrowing cigarettes from me all day long, and then he'd get a packet, and I'd go, can I have a ciggy? And he'd open the packet and look quizzitively at it and go, oh, I've only got 19 left. You know, I thought, well, bugger you. But he was irresistible, and we had truly amazing times.
Well, it seems like it, you know, interviewing various people, it seems like he got around and was all, what we call now networking. I mean, it seemed like I interviewed Andy Roberts recently, and he met Viv in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival when he was playing euphonium there.
Got about, well, he did, you know, he was in the Navy.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was in the Merchant Navy just before he turned up at art school, and had quite an outrageous year, going out to the Far East and working on a couple of cruise ships as a waiter. And I remember him telling me that when the sea was particularly rough, all the waiters, when they weren't actually serving, they would stand at the end of the dining room or an old link arms behind their backs and overemphasize the swaying motion just ever so slightly, and it was the cause of much vomiting and seasickness. And he told me some amazing stories, most of them unfit for television.
Right.
But,
oh, that's funny.
Yeah, and horrible things they did to each other if you crossed somebody,
yeah.
They would insert a razor blade into the bar of soap.
Ooh.
So when you showered, you and you weren't quite aware that you were cutting yourself to ribbons.
Oh my God!
Ooh. It's pretty hard. It's just, you heard it all here, folks, in the Leg Barry Smith Hour.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, hijinks on the high seas.
Oh, well, God, yeah, hijinks on the high seas. Sonoma County, okay.
Yeah, so you go, yep, over the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, well, it's fairly close to Marin County then.
Yeah, it's just, it's the next county just beyond Marin.
Oh, wow. Well, I wrote my musical, my Hitler musical over there.
Oh, really?
Call Me Adolf, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was working with Gary Kellgren of Record Plant.
Oh, Record Plant, yeah.
Well, Gary owned Record Plant, and Gary... And I met Gary over in England. He was doing some work with the Rolling Stones, and we were hanging out at Ronnie Wood's house. And I happened to mention that I'd released Springtime for Hitler, and I was toying with the idea of a full-length musical. And he said, wow, that sounds really, really great. So he actually was the angel. He bankrolled the project and flew me over to L.A. to begin work on it.
Did you enjoy it up in Marin?
Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah. I was part of the time down in L.A. and the other time up in Marin was a crazy German, as it happens, and his New York lady called Dawn. It was just crazy, wonderful times. I think probably the most favorite times of all. America in the 70s, or California in the 70s.
Mm. Where,
for me, I had a wonderful time.
Yeah, Marin was, at that time, Marin was known for hot tubs and peacock feathers.
What's the relevance of the peacock feather?
I mean, it was meant to have been like, you know, they would be softly brushed on naked skin next to the hot tub type thing.
That's what you meant, yeah.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. They're supposed to be bad luck in their peacock feathers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep, over here they are anyway, but who cares? I mean, if somebody's nice enough to do that to you, it can't be bad, can it? I don't think. Yeah, Marin County, I know where you are, and yes, wow. Have you heard my Hitler stuff, by the way? Have you?
I don't think I have, actually.
Well, I really do recommend it. If you're going to play some stuff, I'd love you to play... Or at least listen to it. It's you can get it off iTunes.
I will do that. Okay.
And the musical is called call me Adolf.
Okay.
And obviously the first track is Springtime for Hitler.
Of course.
Mel Brooks, Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah.
But four of the five tracks were produced by Gus Dudgeon, Elton's guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they really are amazing, beautiful pieces of music, which we recorded in the in 78, when there was no expense spared. We've had orchestras, choirs, alpine bands, school kid choir. It was just absolutely amazing.
Did people wear lederhosen and stuff?
Almost, yeah. Well, I put all my images up, you know, because I tend to, when I write a musical, I tend to work out what's going on visually, so I create all these illustrations and stuff, and so I pinned all this artwork up in the green room, because literally coachloads of musicians and singers and actors were being bussed into Gus's studio, and I thought, that, you know, sometimes sessions people have no idea what the project is, they just knock on the door and say, hello, I'm the bass player,
right.
They come in, you know, and as I'm sure you know, so this time I thought it would be rather good for them suddenly to say, yeah, now they're going to start singing about Sir Hitler. And just, I thought I'd sort of break the ice a little bit and warm them up a bit by showing them these very funny drawings. And they all loved it. They all thought, oh, I get it. Most of them are the producers anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't wait to burst into the studio and do their bit.
Definitely.
One of which is called the Führerberger, where Hitler, it's a fantasy sequence where he dreams he owns a chain of Führerberger bunkers.
I first saw you back, you know, in the mid-60s and on TV with Do Not Adjust Your Set, and then obviously the Magical Mystery Tour. That was what a purple period that was. What incredible creativity was going on at that time. Can you tell us, give us a flavour of what was going on there?
Well, you're absolutely right. It was amazing, but it's like anything. You know, if you live near the sea, you hardly ever go to the sea somehow. And we were working very hard, so obviously we were aware of it all happening. But it didn't have the impact then to us as it does now, I think, to people looking back on it. Mm. Yeah, we were right in the middle of it, and so it was obviously thrilling, and our ears got used to really fab songs on radio, and great albums were coming out every other week, and people were doing great things architecturally, fashion, the whole thing was exploding, and it was, you know, they were wonderful times, which... In a way, it was beginning to get me in terms of Bonzo and our performance, because we were every night we were putting on these old costumes and playing these crazy old songs from the First World War and the Second World War, and they were wonderful, and I was enjoying it, but. You know, every afternoon, Viv and I were going to see an Elvis movie or listen to the Beach Boys or something, and catching a Zappa concert, or
yeah.
I'd go off to see Liberace at the Palladium. And I was beginning to think that maybe we should start doing some of these songs, parodying some of these episodes that were all around us, you know, for Christ's sake. And,
right.
And I eventually won. We kind of went electric, as they say. We put down our banjo, and we put down Dear Sam Left, because I took over on drums, and maybe you probably know all this anyway, but, you know, we went electric, as I like to say, and we changed direction. And probably after our first album, we went to Lake Trishman, and so, you know, it was the way to go. I felt it was the way to go.
Oh, yeah, and, well, it's interesting, reading Jollity Farm, that basically it was funny that the the tuba was the way you got into the band. It seemed like that was like handed around to everybody.
Absolutely. I never could master the damn thing. I mean, I took it home. It was really keen to get me into the band, and I took it home and practiced on my mother's carpet for about a week and blew my brains out and managed to get a note. It is quite an easy, one of the easiest of instruments to get a sound out of, and so I was kind of, but it never was really me. I much preferred. I couldn't wait to get on the drums. In fact, okay. That was the thing with the old tuba. But I had more fun putting it on my back and walking very slowly across stage and saying, "What am I? What am I?" And they would say, "I don't know. What are you?" And I'd get, "I'm a snail." Because if you put the thing on your back, it does have a sort of vague resemblance to a snail, or I thought it did in my cups. And so, you know, I had more fun doing that than actually blowing the damn thing.
Yeah, as a prop, yeah.
As a prop, exactly.
So you went to your love of on the drums, yeah.
Yeah, I did. No, that time I started tap dancing.
Yes.
Which was wonderful because I'd always enjoyed dancing. And
what got you into tap dancing specifically? Was that
well, it was at college. It was the art school. The art school had a film club that we used to go to fairly regularly. And one particular night, they showed a movie called The Rise and Fall of Legs Diamond, which is a gangster movie. And this guy would mow down half a dozen people and take his girl off for a dance. And as I was just starting to tap dance, I'd done it when I was 11 at a kid's dance class, if I recall. But I was the only boy in out of 30 sweet little girls, and so I soon left that. I couldn't quite take that. But I picked it up again and started dancing around Holborn Tube Station because it had a lovely ring to it. The marble floors were fabulous. You got a great reverb off the end of it. And I did get serious about it because I thought it was a great, you know, it's tap dancing is only drumming with your feet, basically, right. As I like to call it. It's only percussion. The legs, I nicked the legs from Legs Diamond, to be honest. I thought Legs Larry had a nice ring to it. And so there we are. And I did take one lesson with a chap called Leslie Clackett, would you believe, in Notting Hill Gate.
Oh, yeah.
And he had me going around on one leg for about an hour. And I thought, well, goodbye, Leslie, I've had enough of this. So I literally learned, I guess, by repetition, by doing it every night, you know?
Exactly. And really, you created a whole persona within the Bonzos as well. I mean, there's Viv, he's larger than life, but yet you were doing very well, competing with your own sartorial splendor.
Yeah, Viv and I always took great pride in how we looked, and we were always, dare I say it, well dressed. We would take hours to get ready in our apartments, you know, farting about, wing collars. I mean, when we were dressing in the sort of 20s and 30s, it would literally take us 2 hours to get ready. And we'd have these little routines, and I'd smoke Du Maurier cigarettes because they sold them in tens, and it was a very flat case, almost like a cigarette case, and it wouldn't spoil the line of our suits. And we'd have little silver match boxes on chains, and we'd be a couple of dandies. And we also, which was rather wonderful at that time, we discovered Mossbros, which is a clothes hire firm, as you know, in Covent Garden. And at that point, they were beginning to sell second-hand clothes. And you'd get some poor Duke or some Lord would die, and Mrs. Duke would send all the gear off to Mossbros. You know, I can't stand Archibald's clothes any longer. Ship them off to Mossbros, Robert, thrill you, and get something for them if you can't bugger it.
Yeah.
And so Viv and I would go to Mossbros, to the second-hand department upstairs, and it was run by a couple of jackass from Essex, like, "Hello, Viv, hello, Viv, how are you, mate?" We said, what have we got this week? Oh, I've got a lovely bloody Czech suit here from, and out would come these wonderful suits and hats and waistcoats and things. And the guys would, for a couple of quid alter them for us. Mm. And they'd, as we were leaving, they'd bung in a Mac or something, a fedora hat. And, take this lace, sure, you look good in that. And we'd off we'd toddle with these, with clothes that you just couldn't buy anymore, with materials that were long gone. Wonderful, exquisitely cut suits. Mm. And, it fueled the desire to look even more wonderful. it was fabulous.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I mean, obviously, that fit in perfectly with the whole youth thing, from the mods, transformed from mods into the hippie or flower power. There was that whole mix of fashions going on at that time.
It was great. It was wonderful. And then we stopped wearing 20s and 30s stuff, but then we were still as mad as ever with the choice of materials that we chose then. And also, as you say, we were getting to do not adjust your set, which opened up a whole new wardrobe, literally, to us, a TV wardrobe. And it was, they were wonderful times, absolutely fabulous. But yeah. I think I enjoyed the 70s more, as I say, because California beckoned to me and did consider America to be my sort of second home. And I mean that sincerely, folks, because... I went to America when I was 19, first of all, from college, to get some work experience in New York. Hmm. And I worked in a big... And it's so amazing, is it Mad Men that's on now, this series about the advertising agencies? Well, that was me. I was right in the middle of it, 1964.
Oh, wow.
I was working in the Time and Life building, Rockefeller Center, where the whole damn thing is set. And I'd gone over to America with two chums from the graphics department with portfolios of work, hoping to get just some work experience for 3 or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And they loved us, and it was fabulous. If you were English then, it was just, 64. Oh. The Beatles had hit town, and it was phenomenal. We'd be walking down a sidewalk, myself and my two chums, and literally, cab drivers would slow down, wind their windows down, and go, "You guys are great!" And then just drive off again. We were nothing to do with rock and roll or music. It was just incredible. Girls would follow us for our autographs, and we'd try and sort of escape, but they'd be about 20, 30 yards behind us, all with four, five, six girls. And they'd eventually come up to us and pluck up courage and tap us on the shoulder and say, "Would you guys please sign for us?" And we'd go, we're nothing to do with music. We're students, art students. Yeah, come on. And Eric Burdon was over there at the time, and the Animals. And so I swear to God, I signed Eric Burdon. And I gave it to the other guys, and they signed their name, and the girls went, "Oh, gee, thanks." And they ran off, and just leave us alone. But and somebody said we were Peter and Gordon. Remember them?
Oh, yeah.
On some pier. Was it in Atlantic City? We were there for the day, and we were walking down the sidewalk, and some guy had a microphone and was sort of selling something or other.
Yeah.
Maybe burgers or something, or balloons. And said, "Look, folks, it's Peter and Gordon." We looked around to try and find Peter and Gordon, and he was pointing at us. And we ran like buggery down the sidewalk, the boardwalk, whatever it is, and jumped into a restaurant and locked the door, kind of thing. And I said, "Wait a minute, I like this." But the plan was to go back to America, try advertising. That's what I wanted to do, But then Bonzo came along, and here we are.
So were you actually in America when you joined the group, or?
No. We still had a year to go. It was the last vacation before our final year. Mm. So I went back to England, and that was when Viv asked me to join Bonzo. Mm. So it would be 65 then. And I think I left college late 65, or along with Viv. late 65, but early 66. And in fact, Viv and myself were going to Milan to head up a design agency. And we got so thoroughly blotto and blottoed our copybooks at the getting to know you office party that they didn't ask us. The invitation was hastily withdrawn. And so we looked at each other and thought, well, maybe Bonzo then. Let's have a go.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But not a lot of people know that. But, I was back, you know, we were doing the pubs then at that point, twice a week. The first one we went to was an East End, a typical East End boozer, and nobody applauded. All the guys, mainly guys, jam-packed in there. I think they were probably used to girls disrobing most of the time, but they loved the band because we were just so irreverent, you know. We were just so anarchic. We didn't give a damn. And they never applauded because they had, you know, probably a burger in one hand and a pint in the other. And they would just roar. These guys would roar. And the same at the other place, the Tiger's Head. People just had never seen anything like it. And because we didn't take ourselves too seriously then, I don't think we ever really did, but the audience are very good at picking up on that sort of stuff, and they thought we were genuine, we were just completely mental, and so they loved us. And then they started to get more and more and more crowded, and then they started queuing around the block to get to us, and then the manager arrived, you know, Reg Tracy. Hello, boys. I'd like you to sign here, and I'll make you rich and fabulous. And he came along, and we said, well, let's give it a go, kind of thing. But it was fun to. But you know, as any of the guys will tell you, it was really just letting off steam at night after a hard day's work in Ladbrokes or the pub or maybe college. You know.
Right.
We didn't really think we were going to go anywhere at that time, anyway.
Yeah, interesting. It was, all just for the sheer fun of it and see what happens. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, that's good. That's how it should be. That's what creativity is.
Absolutely.
You don't necessarily know what the outcome is going to be, but it should be fun along the way.
Yeah, that's the joy of it. That's the art of it, as you say.
And now, you went from like pubs, then you were going to like UFO, the ultimate psychedelic club as well.
Yeah, that was a little bit later. If we're absolutely perfectly frank, this manager turned up and waved the contract at us, and because he was managing a band called Kenny Ball, which is a kind of middle-of-the-road jazz band, who weren't that brilliant, but they commercially they were pretty well established, and he was managing them, and he said, "Look, there's a group of nightclubs up the northeast called the Bailey Circuit, and I'd like to get you up there. I think you'd be very good." So we went from these pubs, an art school, straight into Northern Cabaret. So we were stuck up there for 6 to 8 weeks doing these clubs. I mean, they were wonderful clubs, but we hadn't visited, you know, the UFO, all those clubs, and we hadn't done many universities either. It was only, I think, when the TV came along that we started to do the Maybells and the universities and the tellies and, I don't know, it's all a bit hazy.
Yeah, the 60s were.
They were. I got they were.
But, I still have a vivid memory. I haven't seen what's been reissued, but on Do Not Adjust Your Set, I always have a vivid memory of you guys singing a song, all, I think, in bathtubs and with the Aqualung outfits on. I mean, that was just...
Well, it was... yes, I'm sure we did. I mean, it was a really nicely produced show and a great, great crowd. Obviously, the Pythons were in, the pre-Python lot were there, and... But we could get whatever we wanted in the way of props for our single number. We'd phone up Jerry Brown, who was our manager by then, from the from wherever we were, maybe a week's cabaret somewhere, and say, Jerry, this is our order. Should we place our order, please, for next week's thing? And we would just wind them up something terrible. And Lillian, Jerry's wife, didn't have much of a sense of humor. In fact, I don't think Jerry did, actually. Some of the things, Lillian, hello, Lillian, yes, have you got a pen? Yes, we'd like one petrol tanker. One petrol tanker, any particular brand? We'll make it BP. This is absolutely true. We'd like a large diving board from a swimming pool. A large diving board from a swimming pool. One large diving board from a swimming pool. 4,000 ping pong balls. 4,000 ping pong balls. I mean, she'd be writing all this stuff down at the end of the phone, and we'd be just falling about. I mean, it was just fabulous. But it was a great little show to do, and all the Pythons were sweet, and Terry Gilliam was knockout, and, you know, a good bunch. And Michael, Terry, David Jason, that's his name, yeah.
Oh, David Jason, yeah.
Mr. TV now, I mean, you know, he's sort of, you know.
He's done a lot of series, yeah.
He's just Mr. TV, I think, but television. He's done The Darling Buds of May, which I think was my favourite thing he did since. Catherine Zeta-Jones.
That's right.
She was with him, wasn't she? And then she ran away and met Mr. Douglas.
Yeah, it's amazing. You never know what the springboard to success is.
Well, it was one of our... I think she used our diving board from a swimming pool to get her off. Michael Douglas was driving a petrol tanker at that time. And not doing too well. He met Zita, Catherine Zita.
In a hot tub full of 4,000 ping pong balls.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jolly D.
After the Bonzos basically broke up, you did touring with a lot of pretty big people.
A lot of wonderful people, yes. Yeah. Well, I started hanging out with our George then, you know, and we became real close. And touring with Elton was just fabulous. And Bonzo, as you know, did two tours of America, but they were pretty badly organized, and the management didn't really know what the other... Yeah. But the agency was doing, and vice versa, and the agency didn't know what the record company was doing, and it was a bit of a balls up, really, if we're honest, and very frustrating, and no budget. And then, of course, Elton comes along, and I'm flying first class suddenly, you know, which is, of course, what I should be doing. And I'm going all around, and suddenly there's a tour that's really well organized. You know, your suitcase is lifted out of your sticky hands outside your hotel room in the morning, and then it's plunked down in the next hotel 1,000 miles away, you know, the next day. It's wonderful. I could do with a lot of that. In fact, I'm thinking of getting a band together and coming over to America to do some stuff. I'd love to do that. I really would.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I'd like to get Bonzo over there. I'd like to get three Bonzos and eight pianos over there. But I think Roger has this real fear of flying, believe it or not. And he's very reluctant to go. But that's Bonzo. But I've been working on my new music. And I kind of think that it might just go down reasonably well if I can get a band together. I've got several people... jumping up and down saying let's do it, but I'm now suddenly a family man. I don't know whether you know. I have twin girls, identical girls, age 6.
Oh.
Can you believe it? Do you have a family?
I do have a daughter, yeah.
Well, I got married late in life, and 6-7 years ago to a gorgeous girl. Twins came along. Can you believe it? Twins. And
you're Mr. Wonderful, that's why.
You're damn right I am. see those biceps, Mr. Apollo.
Right.
I tell you, it was a shock. It was a shock in many ways because my wife was 7 months pregnant before we realized, before we were told. It's all going in my book I wrote, and it's, you know, in my autobiography.
When's that coming out?
Well, it out, I would hope next year. I'm talking to people right now about it. The touring thing and me, I mean, it's leaving the family, you know what I mean? It's kind of it's a big decision to make.
That's true. At that age, you know, they're just starting school and everything, so...
Exactly. It's very, very difficult. And
have you taught them tap dancing yet?
Not quite, but they dance. Like, they dance all the time, and yeah, they love music, and it's wonderful. As you know, being a parent, I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Something I thought would never happen to me, but here we are. Well, my solo album comes up. Can I send you a couple of tracks?
Oh, absolutely. I will definitely...
I've got one which I'm calling Okie Okie, which is George in Hawaiian, because George, you know, wrote a song about me. Did you know that?
Which one was that?
He wrote a song about me called His Name Is Legs, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, okay.
From his album Extra Texture.
Oh, yeah, Extra Texture, yeah, yeah.
And so I've written one about him, and but he's on it as well. And I'm also doing another version of Jollity Farm.
Oh.
And he's playing ukulele on that, which is fantastic.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable, because, you know, he's mad keen on ukulele. I could quite happily spend the rest of my life in a recording studio, in some deep, dark recordings. I really could, because I was never really into production when the band were moving about, you know. It never really interested me that much, but I'm interested in it now. Production and arranging, I love it. I absolutely love it. And on the same hand, I can quite happily sit in front of my computer and do artwork for the rest of my life, you know.
But
then you go on stage, and then it's wonderful. You know, the show on Sunday was just fab.
Yeah.
You know, with the bongos, and I love being on stage. And
it sounds like you get the best of all worlds then, really.
Well, you know, there's never a minute to fart about and twiddle your thumbs.
Right.
I have led, considering the things I've done, and I think giving up alcohol 6 years ago had a lot to do with it, which
yeah,
I did, you know, because I just had to do it, because, quite frankly, I spent most of my life in a bar and, you know, thinking, oh, well, I won't do anything today, I'll just get that new musical off the ground tomorrow, you know. And,
right,
and I won't do... I'll just do it tomorrow, and I'll... Oh, hello, hi, yeah, how are you? You're coming and have it? Yes, fine. I'm Nathan Aerosmith, and yes, I used to be in Bonzo, and yeah, I did. We did it. Yes, I will. I'll have a large... thank you. I'll have a pint. Yeah, that's been the last 40 years of my life, quite frankly. 50 years of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm not... I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm sort of quite amazed to say it, but it's practically true.
Yeah.
You know, there have been some good times on alcohol and some horrible times on it. Anyway, here I am out the tunnel. I come out the tunnel, and here we are.
With beautiful girls to cherish,
yes.
Yeah. What music are you playing? In your style, when you're recording, are you going... different ways? Or?
Yeah, much, much different to Bonzo. Believe it or not, there are a couple of dance tracks that I've done. I listen to people like Boz Scaggs, Todd Rundgren, Joe Jackson, all the other favorites, of course, but I guess, I don't, you know, it's hard to say what kind of music it is. It's very un-Bonzo-ish, let's say.
Okay.
There's a mad streak of humor running through it. But the new stuff that's coming out is very different to that, and it's very different to
yeah,
Bonzo. I'm working with a guy called Guy Daigle, who was over in Hollywood working with some movie composers, Trevor Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Who did a lot of movie stuff. And Guy's back over here now. And so we work in the studio, and basically using Logic. But he's got some wonderful orchestral samples and stuff. He knows how an orchestra sounds, how it should sound. So we have some very big sounds, and we have some very tender sounds. Like, we've got George playing ukulele on Jollity Farm, which Gus Dudgeon was producing before he died.
Okay.
And, you know, George, we spoke to Ringo. Ringo's supposed to be singing the vocal, but I think we're going to get, hopefully get Jarvis Cocker to do it now.
Oh, okay.
It's a reworking of Jollity Farm. I'm calling it Jollity Farm, the Laboratory Mix. Because it's got a kind of dance beat behind it. It's got quite a groove going on behind it. And I've written a story to go with it called Jollity Farm. And Jollity Farm is acoustic, organic, it's all in Technicolor. It's a wonderful little place. Bonzo the dog lives there with all the Bonzos. And Misery Farm, this evil factory farm that's in a dark, decaying, dead wood. And so Bonzo's girlfriend, Fifi the Poodle, gets kidnapped and taken off to Misery Farm. And basically the story is how Bonzo and the Bonzos go and rescue her. You know, and there's inside the inside Misery Farm, there's that mouse with an ear on its back. You know, they started to grow an ear on the back of a mouse, a human ear.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Yes.
These mad buggers that do all this genetic engineering and stuff. And so we're making a point against the horrors of factory farming and intensive farming and pollution and chemical stuff, but we're doing it with a bit of light and shade through humour, which I think is the best way to get points across myself.
I agree totally.
And George loved the idea, and so he said, what can I do? And I said, well, do you want to play ukulele on it? He said, yeah, sure. So the bed track is just George on ukulele, and it is so beautiful. Mm. And it's so beautiful that we're lifting it off, and we're gonna just do another version of it with just a much simpler version, because the main version has got everything but the kitchen sink on it. It's one of my over-the-top productions. You know, we've got bits of Tom Forrest from The Archers, and if you're worried about the blood, put little bags over their heads. And it's as intense as Springtime for Hitler was in terms of overdubs and recording, and so we're having a lot of fun with that, you know. And I've got an agent that wants to turn it into a video game, which would be fun.
Oh my goodness!
Because as you said earlier, we should be out there. Mm-hmm. We should be spreading the message. We did the tour, you know, a couple of years ago with Stephen Fry and Ade Edmondson and all those people. And every time we went to the theatre managers came up to us afterwards and said, guys, we've never seen audiences leave our theatre like this. They're all 4 yards off the pavement, having a wonderful time, you know. Humans of all ages were digging the show. And that's why I think it's a crime that we can't get over to you in California and America. You know, I think we could personally fix that oil slick.
Oh, my goodness, what a great idea.
I think we could get Bonzo to swim underwater and do a giant poo to cover it. And I could tap dance on top of it to pat it down and stop the sonic thing.
In that old scuba outfit you had. From Doolittle Just Your Set, yeah.
So there's lots to be done. There's work to be done.
Really, what fun, you know, to have it come back like this and be able to go on stage and do the old stuff, do new stuff, you know.
I know, it's my eyes are watering thinking about it, because we haven't really changed. We're all still pretty healthy, you know, and looking as I did the other night across the stage, it hasn't really changed since the 60s. Okay. We're all in wonderful gear, and Roger's robots are still lurking about, and there are a million signs going up. And it could, you know, you could take a shot of it, and you could be back in the 60s.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed visually, apart from Mr. Wonderful being even more wonderful than he was.
Experience, you know, does that, yeah.
It does. You know, I'm encouraged by your remarks. Well, I mean, you know, the Beatles invited us to be in Magical Mystery Tour, and you can't get better than the old Fabs, can you?
Well, what an honour. The only band to ever, you know, be in a Beatle film. That's just...
Movie, I know. You know. And if you look at the credits, it says cast, and it says Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, then the Beatles. I don't ever seen that, but it's true. It's true. Which is quite quite alarming.
It is. Although what's weird, when I've watched it on TV over here, they had it on a few years back on the Disney Channel, and they cut your piece out.
Oh, no, just because of the strip.
Because of the stripper, I think.
Oh, God, America, it's so strange in that department.
I know. The best bit of the film, and they take it out.
Oh, dear. Oh, my God.
So,
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and take care of yourself over there.
Well, thank you very much, Legs Larry Smith.
Okay, bye, everybody in sunny California. Okay, nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Larry.